I don't think you found that recipe in the Homicide Detective's Guide to Grilling. She pointed her spoon at Wills. He laughed. No, but you might be surprised at how many homicide guys are vegetarian, or at least don't eat red meat. They were still sitting at the table, finishing peaches and ice cream that she'd served in two mismatched bowls. Outside the lit porch, evening had glided to night. Betty Carter's voice carried from the living room, "This evening has been so very nice." You know, you'd make a great detective. You've had me talking all evening about myself, my cooking, my dogs. Wills put his spoon in his bowl, pushed back from the table, silent, waiting for her response. Salt pulled her index fingers across the underside of each eye, looked out to lights that could only be fireflies, but that seemed now doubled up, blurry. After a silence, she said, "I don't want to deceive you, Wills." "Who are you protecting, Salt? You or me?" "It's easier for me to talk about work. I wasn't going to. Didn't want to bring Chanel into this. Didn't want to confuse this. Things." She quickly corrected herself. "I don't want to talk about the job tonight. But when you talk about work, you tell me more about yourself than maybe you realize."
"What do you mean?"
Wells reached into his back pocket and pulled out his worn leather badge holder. "You do have the right to remain silent." He smiled, opening the leather and showing the gold shield. "Inferences and deductions, tools of the detective. What you told me about Lil D. Not that many uniforms are as involved. Know their beats as well as you do."
"I thought we weren't going to talk about work."
Salt reached for Wills' badge. "I'm not. I'm talking about you. You could trade on your looks, brains, anything. But you mark yourself with the streets. You risk the hurt to get close to someone like Lil D." Her chest began to feel tight, like there wasn't room for her heart, which began to race. She tried to shrug her shoulders, but they felt stiff.
"It's how I work. How I am."
"That's what I'm saying, Salt."
"Look at this house. How I live."
She stood up and went to the sink, looking out.
"It's a legacy."
Will stood and came to her at the window. "Let's walk." He took her hand and led the way out and down toward the pecan trees. The evening air felt like it was waiting for rain, thunder, lightning, hail, something to break the muggy heat. Even this far out in the country, the city lights sometimes dimmed whatever stars might show through the shifting clouds. She felt like she needed to find her legs and catch some air. She began to walk around the trunk of the big oak, glancing to the dark upstairs windows of the house.
"You're just scared."
Wills sat down on the bottom of the steps with wonder hiding beneath him.
"That's nuts. I'm not scared in the street, but in my own backyard."
She swept her arm toward him, the house and the orchard.
"It's what's in our backyards that scares us all."
She squatted and began to pull at blades of grass. Almost whispering, she said,
"I think my heart or my head is cracked, that something is broken."
"I prefer cracked hearts and heads."
"Look, I'm not trying to fix you. I know special when I see it."
He stood up, walked over, and reached out his hand to pull her up. Then he let her hands go and touched the center of his chest.
"With the things I've seen, my life, I have a heart that looks like a mosaic, all in pieces, held together with a little bit of hope."
He worked his mouth into a smile. Salt's hand moved to the hollow between her breasts, and with a soft fist, she pressed and a sound escaped, like a single tiny sob. Wills gently pulled her against him.
"Let's go in the house," he said quietly, next to her ear. "You can open every door and closet and tell me about you. Then on some other day, I'll lead you through the back door of my heart and show you the pieces."
Salt walked with him to the porch and paused, noticing that some of the porch floorboards had weakened and felt soft and springy, fragile under her feet. Before they reached the kitchen door, she turned and said,
"My name is Sarah Diana. I was named for both of my grandmothers.
Well, for one of my grandmothers and for my other grandmother's breasts."
Grinning slightly, she looked at him. "With a beginning like that, Sarah Diana, the rest of the story can't be all bad."
Betty and Ray were ending, harmonizing, "Baby, It's Cold Outside." The porch light attracted moths. Wonder, following Salt and Wills, jumped and skidded, snapping at the ones that flew too low. Chapter 26 Roadblock. Salt, Pepper, Sarge, Blessing, Big Fuzzy, and the Rookie were holding a roadblock at the bottom of the hill on Meldon Avenue, at its intersection with Middleton Street. Vehicle traffic in the homes was always light. Not many of the residents owned cars. And people who knew anything about the area avoided driving through if there was another route. Most of the rest of the city wanted to forget the homes existed. Where they were set up, cars cresting the hill from both directions couldn't see the police barricade until they were too close to avoid the waiting officers. It was that time in the evening when the sun is close to setting, sending the last light in bright vertical lines. This area of the homes was called the Shadows, a valley between two hills, its lowest elevation. Not only could drivers not see the cops in their cars until they were already headed toward the stop, but the cops' sightlines were also limited. They couldn't see what was coming until the cars were almost there. Here, the evening shadows fell first. They could even claim headlight violations before the rest of the homes and the rest of the city darkened. Usually they made the best of roadblocks, turned them into a kind of goof. Command had ever-changing goals and strategies regarding where and how many would be conducted. This week it was one per shift, rotating through the beats. Even though it strained manpower, they were mandatory details. "May I see your license and proof of insurance?" over and over. "Aw, officer, I was just going to the store. This is not my car. These are not my pants. I don't know whose shit it is." "May I see your license and proof of insurance?" "My date of birth is wrong on that. Some dude gave me this car, man." Like they'd never stopped people who were wanted, driving without a license, in possession of a stolen car, transporting narcotics, denied ownership of clothing wherein contraband was found. "These are not my pants." "Sarge," the rookie called. "Guy here says the pants he's wearing aren't his." He held up a crack cookie in a clear sandwich bag. "Ask him whose pants they are." The handcuffed driver without a license shook his head. "Man, them some dudes staying in the house." Sarge walked over, playing the game. "Dude have a name?" His tone of voice implied cynicism tinged with happiness. They riffed on the perps and on each other. Good riffs were valuable street coinage and could somehow make up for a day of lost autonomy. They complained whenever forced to do anything structured, roadblocks being no exception. Making theater paid them off. As usual, Fuzzy and Blessing were cracking on Sarge. "You so old, you knew Jesus as a corporal." "He pees rust.
and farts dust. Sarge, I think your name was mentioned in the Bible.
Finally, Sarge tried to catch up.
You're both so stupid you'd fail your blood tests. That's lame. Yeah, he's so lame.
They carried on. Salt would have felt safe, but with the tricks her eyes were playing, she worried she might somehow give herself away, that one of them would notice something was off with her. Nearby, a group of little girls watched the cops between turns at jump rope, singing to the beat. Sticks and stones can break my bones, but words can never hurt me. A scrawny, tan dog ran up and began barking at the jumpers. A huge flock of birds and the two big oaks and one failing poplar erupted with a cacophony of squawks and screeches. Somebody in an apartment close by dialed up the volume on a static-riddled radio, and Salt's vision responded, turning tricky and causing her to squeeze her eyes shut, then open them to see the jump rope blurring in double dutch. The rope was fraying in the middle, where it repeatedly hit the ground, and where a shadow image of the girl jumping appeared, a ghost girl, half a second shy of the real one. Stone materialized from between two buildings. He walked by the hard-packed dirt yard, where the girls stopped their game till he'd passed by, headed towards Sam's, his eyes on the officers until he topped the hill and disappeared. They'd been at it for about half an hour when the last of the orange sunset sprang off the chrome of a metallic blue car, its engine revving, coming over the hill from the direction of Sam's. As they all turned toward the noise, the car's tires skidded and squealed on the asphalt. Gray smoke plumed from the burned rubber as the front of the car went right and the rear went left. It came to a stop sideways in the road, a football field away. The car jerked back a few feet, stopped, jumped forward, stopped again, and went silent. Pepper and Blessing started for their cars. They were halfway there when the car began to drift toward the roadblock slowly, motor off as it reached the bottom and the waiting cops. Even in the late light, the birthmark stood out. Lil D was the driver behind a dead engine. Stone was sitting high in the passenger seat. He turned away from Lil D and toward the cops outside his window as the sedan rolled to a silent stop, the flicker of a tightly held grin on his face. Pepper walked up to Lil D, whose arms were stretched rigid, grasping the steering wheel. They all knew the car, knew it would likely have no insurance since it never had, and knew Lil D's license was likely still suspended.
"Aw, come on, Lil D," Pepper said. "Give me a break, please. Your mama just died. Please don't tell me this car is dirty. Man, I do not want to take you to jail."
Pepper was cuffing him as Salt walked over. "Let me talk to him," she said. Blessing and Fuzzy got Stone out and cuffed him. They started the search of Lil D in the car. Lil D kept watch over his shoulder toward the car as Salt led him away to where the girls were jumping.
"They'll find it under the driver's seat, won't they?" said Salt. A quiet question to Lil D, not really asking, knowing.
"Nothing to find," he said.
His voice was low and tight. The girls let the rope go slack in the dust. She turned toward them.
"You know that guy over there?"
The girls' mouths were shut.
"The other guy that was in the car."
Salt looked to the oldest child, maybe about 8 years old. She dragged the rope between her hands.
"That Stone," she said.
The girls were looking away from Lil D, with his hands and cuffs behind his back.
"Did you see Stone earlier?"
Salt asked them again.
"Why you axin' that? You saw him yourself, right when you and them other polices started stopping cars," said another girl.
Lil D sucked in his cheeks, his eyes going hard. Pepper was pulling a bag from under the driver's seat.
"Whoa."
He held it up for the rest of the cops to see. Stone was standing next to the car, cuffed, facing Salt and Lil D. Salt softly asked Lil D,
"Why would he set you up?"
There was no answer from D.
"You gonna take this hit for him?" she asked.
The muscles in his face hardened as he clenched his fists and strained at the handcuffs. He clamped his lips harder and didn't say a word. She waited, holding his arm tight. Then, determined, she led him back toward the others, where Stone was now leaning casually against the car, one foot propped on the front tire. So Stone would know, she asked Lil D again, "Tell us who put the dope in the car." Stone gave Lil D a giddy, curious look, childlike. He grinned and jittered in place. Then he winked a watch-me wink, turned to her and barked, "Ruff!" For a split second, Salt was blinded by a wash of red. She was in his face, could see his jaw muscle jutting.
"You saw this roadblock. You knew we were here, so you had Lil D drive. You had the crack. You set him up. You walked by just a half hour ago."
He turned his head, bunched his lips together twice, and barked again. Sarge and the others stopped whatever they were doing and were watching her closer than they were watching their arrestees. They had never seen her provoke anyone and had no idea what the barks meant to her.
"Tell him, Lil D. Tell Pepper where the dope came from."
She spoke to Lil D while still chest to chest with Stone.
"Salt, I need you to sign the ticket," Pepper said, trying to distract her.
"I'm not signing it."
She was still in Stone's face.
"Salt,"
Pepper repeated, walking up to her with Lil D's ticket to jail. She glanced at the ticket book he was holding out to her and took a step back from Stone, her awareness of his rotten breath sudden. Pepper faked a chuckle.
"Big Fuzzy can sign it. He needs the case anyway. He's always short on felonies."
Again, trying to get back to their previous lightness, cracking on the big cop. It was too late. The last of the sun hit the corner of her eye. She looked over at Lil D. The sunset had washed over his skin and lightened his eyes, making him look more like his mother than ever.
"Give me the ticket. My name will be the only one on it, though. I'll testify."
She took the ticket and signed her name on the bottom line. Sarge and the rest, uncomfortable, looked anywhere but at her. Even Pepper just looked at his hand, still outstretched to give her the ticket she had snatched and signed. She turned to Stone.
"Your day will come, Curtis."
She hit hard on the Curt. "The car goes to impound. You can walk." She grabbed his arm, spinning him, slamming him against the car. The key felt slippery as she searched for the tiny handcuff lock. Stone, free of the restraints, turned slowly and started up the hill toward the dope corner, barking and howling as he went. Pepper lifted his radio mic.
"Dispatch, start the wagon to this location."
In the background, the little girls started their jumping again.
"One for the money, two for the show, three to make ready, and four to go."
Chapter 27 The Thin Blue Line and the Chaplain. The air conditioner in the precinct was stuck on too cold. An icy breeze blasted from a vent below the bulletin board. Salt rubbed her arms, warming them. Sarge was saying,
"The blue line will be very thin tonight, people."
They were standing roll call, and there were only five officers for the early call. There would be even fewer for the late group. The beginning and end of each shift were staggered by 30 minutes, so that cars would still be available and on the street during shift change. Pepper was on Salt's left. Flower, Big Fuzzy, and Blessing were on her right. Sarge called them to attention and then walked down the line for inspection.
God damn it, you motherfuckers look like total bums, he grumbled while he walked behind them.
They all knew he wouldn't write them up. This afternoon, Flower had on the same uniform pants that he had worn the night before, with the same muddy knees. Blessing's dark navy blue shirt was faded to the point that it no longer matched his navy pants. Big Fuzzy had on a winter shirt with the sleeves pushed up. Nobody's uniform allotment stretched far enough to replace pants torn in chases, shirts ripped in fights, or shoes scuffed and scarred by kicking indoors and scraped in street fighting. He tapped her back, as he did each of the others, making sure each was wearing the vest, his tap like a good luck gesture. The flyers, signs of desperation, held to the corkboard by pushpins, flapped in the cold, blowing from the AC. One new flyer stood out. Information wanted on the murder of Chanel MacLeod. Sarge gave them their assignments. Salt, you'll be covering your regular and 305's beat. Pepper, you've got 307 and 303. We have no backup cars, so hump it, folks, but watch out for each other. Fall out. They broke rank and started out for the cars in line, handed over from the previous shift. Salt stopped at the board to look at Chanel's photo, probably the most recent, a blurry shot of her holding a beer can. Big Fuzzy came up from behind and grabbed Salt. In one last moment of revelry, he slung her up in his arms and carried her across the precinct threshold.
I've caught me a fair maiden, I think, but I better check.
Fuzzy, put me down or I'll stick my scepter up your ass. They were all laughing. The not-so-diminutive Salt being swept up by the blonde giant, leaving the precinct like kids, tussling, play-fighting, Fuzz dropping her. Outside the precinct door, Salt trying out new swears on Fuzz, blue goon, sumo ass, noticed the chaplain sitting on the ground beside the lined-up cruisers. He was sifting through a stack of brochures, some of which had begun blowing across the grass and under the patrol cars. He tried to rock his rotund body to a standing position, grabbing for the glossy tracks. One, with the words post-traumatic stress in large red letters, blew against Salt's boot. The chaplain, gathering some of his papers and dropping others, said,
I came to ride part of the shift with you.
He nodded at her. That sent the guys in exaggerated hurrying off to their assigned cars, leaving Salt with the chaplain following her to her car. The ever-cynical cops didn't trust that his main allegiance was to God. Salt began to check the cruiser for new damage from the previous shifts. As she lifted the bottom of the back seat, a favorite place for perps on their way to jail to ditch contraband, the chaplain told her,
Due to budget cuts, chaplains do the follow-ups now. Protocol requires that contact must be made within 6 weeks after a traumatic incident involving officers. It's been 4 months, and you missed 2 appointments with the chaplaincy unit. I have to have documented follow-ups, or the chief chaplain gets on our case.
She remembered balling up 2 pink message slips. The chaplain was wearing a suit coat, a clerical collar, and a vest of the non-bulletproof variety. He carefully put one of the brochures inside the car on the dashboard, and the rest he stuck inside his vest.
Those won't save you if the bullets are flying, Salt said.
I'm already saved.
He patted the center of his chest over his heart.
Yeah, but tonight, out here...
She looked toward the fading day.
You might have to be saved again. Just a little. Not the big salvation, I know, Chaplain. That's your department. But I feel responsible for you.
He looked at her like he wanted to say something but didn't. After an awkward minute, she continued.
So you're going to counsel me while we ride my beat and answer calls?
He pulled another sheet of paper from the pocket inside his jacket.
I have to be able to say I've observed you. I need to check off these questions, and then after we're finished, you could drop me off back here at the precinct.
Kind of like making a regular 17, she joked, referring to the standard crime report form.
Oh, no, I'm also going to give you some advice, said the chaplain sincerely, opening the passenger door of the patrol car.
When was the last time you worked the street?
Well, it's been 5 years or maybe more, but I haven't lost touch.
Where's your weapon? He blanched, then patted his pants pockets, just in case he had remembered to carry his gun.
I'll try to keep us out of trouble, said Salt, pulling away from the precinct.
As they drove the few miles to her beat, the chaplain smoothed the questionnaire on his knee and began to make check marks on the form.
Officer Salt. That's not your real name. It's here on the follow-up form, Sarah Diana Alt.
He was using his knee as a writing surface.
3306, radio called.
3306, she responded into the mic. 3306, respond to a woman in labor at 1441 Jonesboro Road.
3306 copies, 1441 Jonesboro. Your date of birth? He asked, making another mark on the debriefing form.
June 10th. We've got to go deliver a baby, Chaplain.
Couple of months ago, your birthday.
Yeah.
How did you celebrate?
Is that a question on the form?
No, but I'd like to know.
Let's just stick to required information, okay?
They pulled up to a small, tattered house with broken toys scattered around a bare, dirt yard, bordered by a tiny fringe of grass. Two little girls in shorts, but no shirts, sat on concrete steps at the front door, centered on the middle of the house. Salt got out and started toward the entrance, then realized that the chaplain wasn't getting out. She walked back and stood beside the passenger window. He was staring at the form. He rolled the window down. As the glass descended, a woman's scream came from inside the house.
Jesus!
You coming in? She asked.
Without looking up, he said,
I faint if I see blood. Communion wine is as close as I come.
One of the little girls came running up and pulled at Salt's forearm.
You go help my mommy.
She gave off a sharp, tangy odor of urine and sour milk. Salt leaned down. The ambulance is on the way, sweetie, and I'm going in to help her right now.
The chaplain opened the car door.
You and your sister can stay outside with me.
The little girl backed away a little.
Bears are in the trunk.
Salt handed him the keys. Inside the house, which was hotter than outside, a young woman wearing a loose green skirt sat on a soiled couch in the living room. Her legs were spread, and her belly under an oversized T-shirt was huge. She was groaning.
Where's the ambulance?
She cried. An even younger woman, hardly out of her teens, came from another room carrying a cloth dripping with water and began washing the pregnant woman's face.
You gonna be all right, Sheffy?
Close body smells hung in the air of the small room.
How far apart are the pains?
Not no time, answered the younger woman. Oh, sweet Jesus,
moaned Sheffy, rolling to her side. Salt watched as amniotic fluid soaked her skirt. The odors intensified. Salt tugged at her shoulder mic and pressed the button to transmit.
3306 to radio. Can you give me an ETA on the ambulance? Stand by, 3306.
Easy for you to say. Salt mumbled without keying her mic. The woman scooted down to the floor with her back resting against the ratty sofa. She rolled her head from side to side, and then there was a sudden, sharp, tangy smell.
The baby! The baby!
She cried, and slid farther to the floor, raising her knees and spreading her legs.
Radio, advise on the ambulance,
Salt demanded from dispatch while she knelt beside the groaning mother.
ETA 10 minutes, answered radio.
The younger woman had backed away to the wall of the room and was chewing on the cloth she had been using to wash Shuffy's face. Salt turned to her.
Go get clean towels, clean clothes, anything clean. Now.
She moved around to a position at Shuffy's feet. She'd delivered 5 babies during her time in the homes. It seemed like not only did children have to grow up fast here, but also they were often born too fast. The mother-to-be yelled, crunched her head to her chest, and pulled her skirt above her thighs. The top of the baby's head, slick with fluids and shiny black hair, was emerging. Salt spread the fingers of her right hand.
I'm going to help your baby.
She cupped her hands under the baby's head. The woman gave another cry, and Salt was holding all but the feet of a squiggling baby girl. Salt's eyes stretched wide. Shaking her head to keep sweat from running and making her blink, she whispered,
Wow,
and touched the new skin of the baby's cheek. The tiny girl gobbled her first breath. Just as the baby coughed and came completely clear of her mother, the door opened and the paramedics rushed in carrying their bags. They began unloading their med gear and snapping on gloves.
Looks like a girl, one of the medics announced, tearing into a sterile blanket.
Salt looked up at the baby in her bare hands.
Accurate diagnosis, she said, feeling smiley.
Her fingers formed a careful cradle around the newborn.
A girl, groaned Shuffy.
A girl, Salt said, with a second short prayer that this mother wouldn't go missing, go to jail. Or die. A prayer that this mother might protect this child. Salt had washed off with bottled antiseptic from the trunk. The baby was healthy, and the whole Distaff family had trundled off in the ambulance. First thing when she sat back in the car, the chaplain shuffled his papers and, without looking up, said,
I should have at least baptized the baby.
He lifted his head and watched the disappearing ambulance. Back in service, with the chaplain still trying to check off his questions, she drove the beat, her hands still tingly.
Nightmares? He read from the sheet.
Nope.
Flashbacks?
Only to my childhood,
she tried to joke.
What about your childhood?
He thought she was being serious.
And why do you mind if I asked about your birthday celebration? Did you get drunk?
I was joking. She turned the car down a narrow alley where abandoned, stolen cars were often discovered.
Officer Alt, can we stop here for a minute?
Sure.
She put the car in park but left the motor running. The cruiser's headlights illuminated what appeared to be a new SUV about a block down the alley. The vehicle was jacked up, wheels missing.
You have a job to do. So do I.
He tapped the forms to align them. She pointed down the alley at the SUV.
I know it's the stolen car. Can't you just leave it for a minute?
He asked. Maybe it was used in a murder or robbery, and maybe there's evidence in it that will solve a crime.
Or maybe you don't want to be talking to me about your shooting.
He made another check on the form. The hair along her new scar felt like straw. Salt resisted the urge to rub her scalp.
There's nothing to talk about. He shot me. I shot and killed him.
She reached for a paper towel in the side door compartment and began wiping the window in front of her, worried she had said the wrong thing.
You're cleaning a clean window, he said,
giving her a glance. She stuffed the towel back in the door.
Your follow-up could get me transferred. Someone will look at that form you're filling out and make a judgment about my fitness for duty.
That's not what this is about. Look, I might not be or ever have been a great cop, but I know one when I see one. You're the real thing. I'm embarrassed that you delivered that baby with me outside.
Chaplain, no, let me continue.
I'm not even a good chaplain. I follow departmental procedures, but they don't seem to be of help to wounded and troubled cops. So, let me just say that the best I can do is to tell you that I hope you're not having any problems because of getting shot, or anything else.
He folded the checkoff sheet, put it in his pocket, faced forward, and swallowed hard. After a second or two, she put the car in drive and pulled up to process the abandoned auto. They hadn't said anything more on the way back to the precinct. In the parking lot, Salt asked, "Which is your car?"
"Green minivan."
He pointed to a battered older model van. A rear bumper sticker proclaimed "Jews for Jesus" and featured a cross superimposed over a Star of David.
"Got a couple of major religions covered there."
She tried for a lighter note, pointing to the sticker. Still quiet, he answered,
"I guess."
"Okay, chaplain. You earn your stars today." Salt paused and drew a long breath. "I don't celebrate my birthday at all. Birthdays were hard for my father. I do have flashbacks about him. Maybe you heard talk. He was with the department. He committed suicide on my 10th birthday." She shrugged. "Really, the only birthdays I feel like celebrating are like the one today. I'll lift a glass of wine tonight to Shuffy's new baby. Do I fail to follow up?"
They were both blue and white reflections on the windshield. "No, you don't fail."
"Thank God." Salt let out a long, noisy breath.
"That's my line."
He laughed, a strange braying behind his hand. His odd laugh shocked her to laughter.
"You want to come to my office? Drop by any time."
He got out of the car, stuck his head back in.
"Anytime. Anytime."
Salt put the car in drive and waved at him, without looking back. Now, recalling her dream of chairs, a more recent version of the dream, words appearing as a colliding vision on the boards, appearing on the rough boards for building the chairs, in which she now longed to rest. The unknown person still walked forward from the misty dream woods, carrying a sign that she couldn't read. Chapter 28. Court, Lil D, Shell Casings, and Mary Marie.
"All rise," the bailiff called, as the judge entered the dais at the front of the courtroom. Salt stood, along with citizens, cops, and lawyers, cops behind the lawyers in the never-turn-your-back-to-them tradition. She wasn't exactly surprised when Stone entered the courtroom, loping without grace, his shoulders folded inward. When he saw her across the room, he stopped, turned, and just stood, no expression, flipping his cap between his hands. Court didn't allow hats. Stone's hat hair was mushroom-shaped. A cop behind her tapped her on the shoulder.
"What's that asshole's problem?"
He thumbed in Stone's direction.
"He's having a bad hair day."
Her colleague laughed and relaxed, telling her a bit of the latest gossip around his precinct, until the bailiff called the first case. Waiting to be called for Lil D's first appearance on the possession with intent to distribute charge, Salt felt nervous for the first time since her rookie courtroom days. The headaches were becoming more intrusive. Her vision was increasingly populated by phantom lights and floaters. As they sat, the court continued to fill with families of suspects, victims, and victims' families. There was rarely a difference between the accused and the accusers. Very young women with babies on their hips, and grandmothers with babies on their hips, were in abundance. Chanel's generation was missing, but the courtroom was packed. Too much of the culture of the homes was being shaped by Budweiser commercials,
the celebrity of the moment, what they were driving and wearing. Bling over substance. Modesty had gone the way of mules. Quite a few of the women and girls who came to court were sent out by the judges for improper attire, while others barely made the cutoff. Case after case, young men, slouching in defiance, were led from holding cells. When Lil D's name was called, he was led out, blinking, looking thinner and hungrier than ever. Stone stood up and went to lean against a wall in Lil D's sight line. He covered his mouth with his cap. His face muscles moved like he was talking behind it, though he made no sound. Lil D looked at Stone, then turned back to stare at the floor. The judge recited, rather than asked Lil D, the questions regarding his ability to afford a lawyer. Asked if he had held a job in the past 6 months, Lil D was barely audible when he answered, "No." His voice sounded weak and unused when he answered, "Yes," to needing a public defender. The judge postponed the hearing for another week. Before the bailiff corrected him, Lil D tried to turn so that the stain on his neck was away from the courtroom audience. Out in the parking lot, Assault opened her car door. Stone popped up between cars and strutted toward her. There were too many cops leaving court for him to cause her any real trouble. He strolled by, inches away, his bony shoulders moving back and forth, like a large bird of prey dancing. By the time she told radio she was back from court, the late afternoon bloodbath in the homes had begun without her. Domestic quarrels were the theme for the night. On Thurkill, a woman held her jaw as she related between sobs her story of abuse, her baby's daddy having fled before Salt arrived. She took the report while a tall, thin man watched, leaning on the corner of the building. It was not Stone. On Shaw, Salt arrived as the paramedics were holding a pressure bandage on a young teenage boy's face. The boy had gotten between his mother's knife and an uncle. Salt arrested the mother. As she was sitting behind the wheel, working on the report, and waiting for the wagon with the caged mother in the back, she flinched when someone slapped the patrol car, her puff of relief audible as an old man stumbled by, and she saw it wasn't Stone. By 9, the assaults had turned deadly, and Salt was stringing yellow tape to preserve, protect, and defend another dead body. The crowd chorus, again, complaining about the slow ambulance arrival time and "police don't care about nothing." The crowd working into a frenzy, potential witnesses scattering. Around 10, the shots fired calls weren't even being dispatched, but the sounds of gunfire ricocheted throughout the homes. Salt sat under a streetlight finishing paperwork, documenting the facts, leaving out details like the color of blood under halogen lights. She kept glancing in the car's mirrors and out the windows, but her night vision couldn't adjust from the reports. Fully automatic gunfire erupted from behind the closest building. It was too much and too close for her to ignore. "Radio, hold me out on shots fired at 1412 Middleton Street. Radio copies. Can any unit start for her location?" The familiar dispatcher knew Salt wouldn't have bothered to call it in if there hadn't been some significance to the gunfire.
3307, Pepper responded. "I'll hold my paperwork. Show me en route."
Instead of getting out on foot, Salt put the Crown Vic in low gear and punched over the curb. The patrol car's undercarriage scraped the ditch as she rounded the corner of the building. Her headlights dipped as the car wheels bumped in ruts and over a drainage pipe. A sports field down the hill was wide, spread out, the center of the homes. Just outside the illumination of the patrol car's lights, dark figures darted in and out below the direct beams, scattering from the center of the ball field. The car door made for good cover as Salt opened it,
the beams of her flashlight adding more specific light to the scene. Her boots skidded on shell casings, the ground littered with shiny brass. What little ambient light there was reflected off Pepper's silver buttons as he walked around the corner of the building.
"Smart girl. It's too late to be chasing gunmen on foot," he said, noting the position of her car.
He added his light to the glitter on the ground.
"Goddamn war zone here," he said,
bending down to pick up one of the brass casings. He examined the casing, rolling it between his thumb and finger.
"We've got to collect all of them."
"Why? We never collect casings on just shots fired."
"We do these, Salt. They're armor-piercing. Remember the flyer the gun unit passed out at roll call last week? These have the markings, same as the ones in the flyer."
He stood next to her, his flashlight shining on the brass in his palm. Salt's stomach turned over. Stone didn't need words. From an open apartment window, the theme song from a popular police drama started up. Dropping shell casings in an evidence bag on the downbeat, she and Pepper kept time to the music. The rest of the week continued with the usual hard and sad life in the homes. Stone was conspicuous by his absence. Her nightmares got so that she'd wake up and find Wonder staring. She trembled in her bed, in her house, where she now felt more on edge than in the homes. Another summer downburst was flooding the streets just as the bus lumbered to a stop. Salt watched from under the tattered awning of a nearby pawn shop. Stereo equipment, jewelry, guns, and more advertised fading painted block letters on the concrete wall at her back. The school bus delivered Mary at 4:22 almost every day, and it was all Salt could do to get out of roll call, load her gear, and get to somewhere near the bus stop so she could watch the girl, always the last one off the bus, and never with another child. Today was the same. Mary never seemed to see her. Salt didn't hide, but did take pains to always park away from the stop, in different places, and walk to some vantage point. On the opposite side of the bus from Salt's view, the children clambered out and dashed down the sidewalks. The bus pulled away, splashing water from the gutter. Mary stood alone, rain sloshing her up and down, running from her braids. A crack of lightning threw the scene into a negative. Mary didn't startle or even move. Salt looked down at her own feet. Bits of wet weeds clung to her black boots, but she could feel the wet socks in Mary's shoes, the ribbing printing itself on her ankles. Memories of her own childhood washed over Salt as she stood watching Mary get soaked. She put herself back against the warm storefront wall as Mary took the first of her plodding steps toward the house where Chanel had once been a child. Mary didn't flinch at the second blast of lightning either. She stood still, rain streaming down her cheeks, and lifted her face as another strike flickered close. The girl seemed more reluctant to go home than to stay in striking distance. Chapter 29. Testifying. The city had lit its courtrooms like live theater. Recessed lighting was dim in the audience and bright up front. The judge's dais was large and raised above a waist-high wooden island, on either side of which the prosecution and defense held forth and negotiated. Salt sat three rows back in the far right section. The thunk of leather-covered metal against the wood benches sounded as other cops arrived. Her gear belt with cuff cases and baton holder at her back filled the normal curve of the bench so that she had to find purchase with her boots to keep from slouching, to be able to see above the front rows of lawyers. She scuffed the floor, letting off nervous energy. In the other two sections of the dim area, A flux of family members, of both the victims and the accused, and a few witnesses, moved either to the front as their cases were coming up, or to the back and out once a disposition was rendered. These were preliminary hearing courts. No trials, no Bibles were sworn over, no gavel was struck. Impatient cops waited their turns. Mothers tried to quiet crying babies and restless children.
"Officer Alt," called the solicitor,
her cue to go forward and play her part, testifying against Darryl Raphael Mobley. She had practiced her lines often enough in similar cases, knew the rules of search and seizure. She stood and walked toward the front of the room. Lil D was led, shuffling, into the courtroom, leg restraints inhibiting the exaggerated side-to-side tough walk. He was wearing the orange jail jumpsuit, pant legs too long and bunching at his ankles. The bailiff positioned him opposite Salt, across the island. The brighter light revealed lint in his hair, which unaccountably provoked Salt's fury. She dug her fingernails into her palms in frustration that there had never seemed to be a way out for Lil D. Lil D, head bent, squinting, and looking from the corners of his eyes, upper lip raised like he smelled something bad, looked like she felt. The solicitor and Salt stood on one side of the polished wood peninsula. Lil D and his court-appointed lawyer stood on the other side. When she turned her head toward Lil D, she involuntarily blinked from the glare. Above them all sat the judge, a bored, cynical veteran of the city courts. The back of a laptop computer was visible on the judge's desk to his right. His hand moved quickly over the trackpad, the light from the screen playing across his face, rapidly changing from green to blue.
"Next case," he called,
his eyes not leaving the computer.
Salt thought he was playing a video game.
The solicitor, who knew Salt well, didn't bother to ask about the arrest. He assumed that this case would be like others she brought to court. It would be solid. His words ran together.
"Your Honor, Darryl R. Mobley is charged with possession with intent to distribute."
The judge, a blue glow on his chin, frowned at his computer, then plopped back in his high-backed chair, waving his hand for the solicitor to begin.
"Officer Alt, tell us how you came in contact with the defendant on August 28th of this year."
Salt looked at Lil D. He'd tried to hide his birthmark by turning up the collar of the prison suit.
"Officer Alt?"
the solicitor prompted, shuffling through the stack of charges on the shelf beside him without looking at her. "Myself and four other officers were manning a roadblock at Meldon Avenue in Middleton Street when the defendant, driving a 1974 Oldsmobile, came through the location." Salt felt something caught in her throat. She covered her cough with a fist and continued. "There was a passenger, Curtis Stone, with the defendant." The solicitor, who'd been at ease because of their familiarity, now cut his eyes. "Stone?" he mouthed silently at her. They both knew it was the job of the defense attorney to bring out the fact that Stone had been in the car, suggesting his relevancy. She was volunteering information unnecessarily. The defense attorney didn't miss Stone either. A public defender, he also knew Salt from previous cases. He cocked his head to look at her, now also more attentive to the case.
"And Officer Alt,"
the solicitor's voice had tightened ever so slightly,
"did you have reason to arrest the defendant?"
Salt looked again at Lil D, who didn't know the script, was unaware of the misplaced lines. Like a lamb to slaughter, he stood there, testifying without saying a word. Salt missed several more beats.
"Officer Alt,"
the solicitor prompted her again. He'd now put down the other paperwork and was looking at her with the same cocked head as the defense attorney.
Yes, yes, Salt answered.
The solicitor moved toward her, making eye contact.
On what grounds did you arrest the defendant?
His words were clipped, precise, and impatient.
He didn't have a driver's license or proof of insurance, she answered.
The words sounded tired, even to her. The solicitor's mouth had fallen open. He turned to the judge.
Your Honor, if I may take a minute to confer with my witness.
The judge snapped forward in his chair.
This is a preliminary hearing. You should have talked with Officer Ault before she began her testimony. Proceed.
He leaned forward toward the computer, his whole face now a light shade of blue. He smiled at the screen.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The solicitor replied automatically, thanking him for nothing. He knew his lines.
Officer Ault, in the process of arresting the defendant, did you witness the recovery of any contraband from the defendant's vehicle?
It wasn't his vehicle, she answered.
The solicitor's lips stayed parted over his very white teeth, speechless. She was choosing another way of looking at things, the way it should go, giving Lil D's attorney a gift, the facts for a defense for Lil D. She wasn't lying. She was telling the truth. But it was out of order, not according to the script, and definitely not for the state. Beyond the lights at the front of the courtroom, the odd congregation, which included her fellow cops, had grown unusually quiet. Even the uninitiated sensed the cops' attention to her testimony. Salt felt the grains of her reputation shifting. The leg irons around his ankles clinked on the hardwood floor as Lil D shifted his feet. He looked frail under the courtroom lighting. She rubbed her hand across her eyes. It was as though every move she or Lil D made was spotlighted.
Officer Ault, please answer the question.
Now the solicitor sounded mystified, annoyed, both.
Were drugs recovered from the vehicle the defendant was driving?
His mouth stayed open again, staring at her over the top of his glasses.
Yes, Salt answered without elaboration, which sent the solicitor into a quick spin on his heels.
Turning to the judge, he recited, Your Honor, I have the results of the crime lab analysis. The analysis found that the drugs recovered from the car the defendant was driving were positive for crack cocaine.
He waved the report at his side. The chains on Lil D's ankles clattered.
Duly noted for the record. Continue with your case, Mr. Solicitor, urged the judge.
The solicitor turned, stared straight back at Salt to get the answer that was required.
Were the drugs in the possession of the defendant?
Salt's next line was supposed to be, yes, they were found under his seat, within his wingspan. She drew a large breath and exhaled.
No.
Lil D lifted his head.
Officer Ault!
The solicitor flapped his arms twice against his suit.
What was your probable cause to charge the defendant with possession?
They were found within his wingspan.
Her voice was limp, without conviction.
No further questions, Your Honor, said the solicitor.
Then he whispered to Salt, I'm unhappy. Although they all knew probable cause was established, enough to bind Lil D over for trial. Except now, the public defender, who usually wore an air of resignation, walked upstage and in a loud voice asked,
Officer Ault, were the drugs found within the wingspan of Curtis Stone also?
Yes, they were.
Blowing her lines, she answered, not bothering to disguise the satisfaction she felt in telling the whole truth, nothing but. The solicitor had turned his back to her, looking out at the audience, playing to the cops. Lil D's eyes were squinched, like he was trying to see something he didn't understand. For a brief second, he raised his head and looked around wide-eyed with what might pass for hope on his face. The public defender, quite aware now of Salt's cooperation, quickly asked, "Was there any indication that Curtis Stone